Hello, folks. This is the Andy Social Podcast. My name is Andy Dowling, bass player for the Australian metal band Lord, host of this podcast, that's right, funnily enough, and the host of the new podcast called Self-Starter. If you go to selfstarter.com.au or search for Self-Starter on Facebook or your preferred podcast player, you will find Self-Starter, hopefully. If it's not out by now, give me a kick up the ass, please. I'm almost there. So Self-Starter is all about small business, self-employment, and freelancing. It's going to cater for three segments of people. It's going to cater for people that are in a job working for somebody else that they hate. They don't have any fulfillment in what they're doing, but they have ideas. They love the idea of working for themselves, but they're too scared to take those first few steps. They don't know how to. So it's going to cater for those people. It's also going to cater for those that have the business concept. They've got the ideas. They've started taking those first few steps and they're getting closer to launching. They're getting closer to opening their doors for trade. And they're hitting that brick wall where they're worried about how the general public are going to respond, how friends and family are going to respond. Is this going to be a success? Do they have enough money? What's going to happen if it all fails? And it could be a point in time where people just don't follow through and actually launch it. And the third segment of people are those that have actually done it. They're out there. They're weeks, they're months, they're years, they're decades into their business. They're with their product and their service. And for those people, I'm really hoping that they get a lot out of this podcast as well by hearing what other people are doing, sharing best practices, learning what other businesses in other industries, in other products and other services are doing. Because as the market and as the world changes, as technology changes, as people's attention continues to change, it's going to be really critical to understand what other people are doing and to be innovative and learn new things and think outside the box to do the best that you possibly can for yourself personally and also for your business. So there's three clear segments of people that will be my audience. And if you fall into any of them, then I really encourage you to go over to Self-Starter and give that a shot. And for any of you guys that have even an inkling of interest in this podcast, please jump over there, hit a bunch of like buttons and social media things and listen to the first couple of episodes to help me give this podcast an initial boost and give it a bit of momentum to get out there. This is a massive project for me. It's been months in the making. I've had to get out there and record a lot of content, convince people to be a part of it, which I'll leave that for a later date. That's been an interesting journey. And all the costs and people involved to really sort of get this up and running. This has been a big thing and will be a big thing for the foreseeable future. So really would appreciate any support you guys can give. It's something that means a lot to me as somebody that has a real keen interest in self-employment and is transitioning into that world. I'm using this as an educational tool for myself. And hopefully as a result, a lot of other people will enjoy and get a lot out of this as well. So selfstarter.com.au, plug, plug, spam, spam, spam. So thank you so much. Okay, so this week's guest, very, very cool guest. This is somebody that I've had on my list. I've got my little podcast notebook, has been on my list since day dot. And it's only been recently that I felt now's probably the right time to reach out and get this person on. So this week's guest is with Matt Mora. Now, Matt is the frontman of legendary Australian metal band Mortal Sin. Mortal Sin's been around for decades. They are, in my opinion, I could be wrong, some expert metalheads out there might be able to correct me, but I believe that Mortal Sin was the first ever Australian thrash band. And after them, a number of other bands came out in the 80s, but Mortal Sin were definitely the pioneers of thrash in Australia. And they've done a lot. They've achieved so much. They've toured the world. They've toured with the biggest bands in the world. They did shows with Metallica on their first ever Australian tour back in the late 80s. They were signed to major labels. They've done international touring with massive bands, Testament, Faith No More, and a bunch of others. They've just done so much. And I sat down with Matt a few weeks ago and we spoke about, I did a bit of This Is Your Life with Matt. We went back to day dot because I really wanted to understand how different things are now for young guys getting started in bands versus what it was like for him and the guys in Mortal Sin back in the day. And then some of those earlier stages and then transitioning into deals, getting phone calls, their music played in a record store in London, getting the Metallica support, all these different things. And it's really, really fascinating. If you're a musician or even if you're not, if you're a music fan, you'll really, really enjoy this. We also talk about sort of what's happening now in Matt's life and I guess the legacy of Mortal Sin and whatnot. So there's lots of cool, interesting stuff in here. I really hope you enjoy it. AndySocial.net is the place to go to check out everything that's Mortal Sin, everything that we speak about. I'm going to put links, videos, lots of cool content. So go over there and check it out. And please reach out to Matt if you have any questions or just want to let him know how much of a legend he is. I'm sure he will appreciate it. So enough of me. As always, please enjoy this fantastic episode with Matt Mora of Mortal Sin. Thanks for having me at your house.
Good old Western suburbs, mate.
Yeah, absolutely.
A long way for you to come. Did you need a visa?
I did need a visa. There was a big gate coming through. I had to go through immigration. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what most people say when they come out this far.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, it's I've been to Seven Hills, but I haven't been this far out. So yeah, it's actually quite nice out here. It's pretty good.
Yeah, it's quiet. It's not quite country, but it's green, you know, and it's peaceful.
Best of both worlds.
Yeah.
Have you been living out here long?
5 years here.
Yep.
We used to live up the Central Coast a bit. We lived in Concord for a bit. We've been all over the place.
Yeah. But always Sydney.
Never been out of New South Wales.
Yeah, really? There you go. Well, that's good.
Living.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I think you've done a little bit of travelling here and there.
Travelling too.
I think I really wanted to... I've had you on my list for ages to talk to, and obviously fascinated with the years of Mortal Sin and what you guys have achieved over the years, but I think... And you're probably going to repeat yourself a million times just from interviews and whatnot that you've done over the years, but I think for me... In the current state of music as it is now and bands doing different things and CDs don't sell as well as they used to and there's downloading, there's streaming and then, you know, people trying to get people off the couch and go to shows and whatnot, I think one thing that a lot of bands tend to miss these days is just the fundamentals, the stuff that separates a band from the rest of the pack. Mm. And for what you guys have achieved over the years... I mean, there's quite a number of factors and obviously being in the right place at the right time. But, I mean, you guys had the tunes. But, I mean, this could be a weird place to start. But what do you think was probably the main things in the early days for you guys that separated yourselves from the rest of the bands playing in Sydney when you were first getting started?
Oh, you wouldn't put it down to one thing.
Yeah.
It's probably a bunch of things. But, look, in all honesty, luck.
Hmm.
Luck, you know, I mean, for every one band that ever makes it, there's 1,000 bands that are just as good. Why did that one band make it?
Yeah.
You know, and luck is really a big element. Right place, right time, in front of the right people. I used to say to people, you know, when they're touring, I said, look, you don't know who's in the crowd.
Mm.
You got to get out there and you got to talk to people. Mm. You don't know that guy standing there might be a manager of another band, or there might be a record company guy, or there might be an agent. You know, like, you'd be surprised at the type of people that are in a crowd just standing there watching you. You don't know. You know, you hope that they're all liking your music, but it just takes one person to see you guys at the right place, right time, to go, I like you guys.
Mm. Was that something that you guys were conscious of when you first started playing shows?
Not at first. No. I mean, look, in those days, we're really talking about the birth of, you know, thrash metal or heavy metal, you know, in Australia around that time, early 80s, you know. So you didn't know anything.
Mm.
Whatever you needed to know, you had to find it out, which is the same today, but... You know, at least today, there's a history. You can look back at a history. For us, history was Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, Deep Purple, that sort of stuff. So when it come to thrash metal, it was like all we'd really heard of was, you know, the Bay Area, the new wave of British heavy metal, which wasn't thrash, but it was like leading into our genre, you know. And when we first heard Kill 'Em All, you know, everyone's jaws just dropped to the ground. It's like, wow, that's what I want to do.
Mm.
That, you know, like, when you first get a band together, you got four or five people all with different ideas of what are we going to play, how are we going to play it, all that sort of thing. And you don't know until you start writing something. You know, a lot of bands might start off playing covers. So generally when you start playing covers, it gives you a bit of an idea of, okay, well, that's what kind of music we like. Is that what we're going to write? You know, is that going to be our style of writing? But when, for me, anyway, personally, when I first heard Kill 'Em All, I just said, that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
That's what I want to do. You know, it was just the style of music. It was, it just seemed aggressive. It seemed powerful. It seemed, it just seemed to encompass everything that I wanted to do in music, you know, especially as a singer. Even that growling singing, I was like, that's just it, you know. And I guess that sort of led the way, you know, that one album.
Yeah.
You know, once you'd heard that, then you wanted to hear everything else. And then back in those days, you know, you had Utopia. Luckily, it's been around since 79. You know, so you had a place that you could go for. Whenever you heard some music, you could just go and go, oh, I want to listen to Metallica. Metallica's on the walls. Or I want to listen to this, I want to listen to that, you know. And pretty much in those days, that's what you did. Today, you just go on the net and you go on Spotify or whatever, you know, you listen to stuff. So, you know, it's just one of them things. It's not too dissimilar to today to what we had to do back in those days. You know, it was probably a little less accessible.
So were you guys friends in school, or did you sort of meet after school? School ended?
No, I didn't know any of the guys.
So was it just a common interest in music and just seeing each other at gigs, or at Utopia? Or
when I met Wayne, we met on a train during a lightning storm, and the train broke down, or it had to stop for some reason. And I'd just come back from a rehearsal. I was at the time I was jamming with some guys who were into Judas Priest.
Yeah.
So it wasn't technically a Judas Priest cover band, but they played probably 5, 6, 7 Judas Priest songs, and then they wrote a couple of their own songs. And so I was actually listening to some songs to get some ideas in my head, you know, on a ghetto blaster on this train. And here's this long-haired lout walks through the train, and he hears the music. He goes, oh, what do you listen to? I said, oh, I'm jamming with a band. He goes, oh, you're jamming with a band. What do you do? Oh, I'm a singer. Oh, I'm a drummer. You know, it was just, I don't know, pot luck that we just both happened to be on the same train. And then he was in a band called Wizard at the time, which was not too dissimilar to you guys. It was a power metal band.
Yeah.
Playing Iron Maiden.
Cool, yeah.
And that sort of style of music. And he said, oh, why don't you come and play with us? And I said, oh, I don't know. Well, yeah, why not? So I went down and I jammed with them. And no, I didn't mind it. But a couple of the guys didn't like me because I wanted to growl. You know,
yeah, right, okay.
And playing in an Iron Maiden style band, they wanted a Bruce Dickinson, whereas I could do Bruce Dickinson, no problem. But it wasn't what I wanted to do, you know. And so we ended up, myself and Wayne took Keith, the guitarist from Wizard, and we said, let's just form our own band. You know, we'll play some really heavy stuff. Because, as I said, it was around the time when Kill 'Em All had come out, late 84. I think we met late 84, but we didn't get a full band together until early 85, I think.
Okay.
And with the three of us, so we had a guitarist, a singer and a drummer. We just needed to find another guitarist and a bass player. So, I can't remember too much how the rest of that happened, but I think it was, you know, we auditioned some guitarists, and then you kind of, as you go to a studio, I think we rehearsed at Party Picks, which is still there. It's over in Girraween.
Oh, right, okay, yeah.
And, you when you go to a rehearsal studio, you kind of get to meet other people, and
you see
the signs on the, you know, the walls, oh, guitarist wanted or guitarist available. So I think it was like word of mouth. Someone said someone else was looking for a band. And, you know, in those days, it wasn't a lot of bands. So, you know, it was pretty easy to find members. And so that's pretty much how that all started, I guess. And in the early days, we went through a few guitarists, probably 3 or 4.
Yeah.
And then, we settled on a lineup probably about mid-85.
So there's a little bit of time going back and forth, just trying to work it all out. And were you guys playing covers to begin with, as you said before, just trying to work out what?
Yeah, even when we did our first shows, we were doing some covers. We did Am I Evil? We did Twisted Sisters, Under the Blade.
Yeah.
What else did we do? Oh, Rite of Violence by Creator. Oh,
yeah. Nice.
Yeah, we did a few because obviously, you know, when you start playing, not everyone has their own songs.
Mm.
You know, I think we started writing straight away. It was, like I said, one of those things where we kind of knew what we wanted to do. We didn't know how to do it, but we figured that out as you went along. Even for me, I didn't even know how to write lyrics.
Mm.
You know, I'd written poetry, but I'd never written lyrics.
Mm.
And so you sort of fuddle along the way, you know, and ideas go together and a song happens, you know, and then once a song happens, you recorded it, you know, you tape recorder, you played it back and you listened to it, and yeah, it's not too bad. These days, you pretty much, everyone's got their own home studio these
That's
days.
It, so yeah. Easier than ever.
Yeah, it's a lot easier, but we wrote a couple of songs, they were really, really basic songs. I remember a couple of them. One of them was just called Metal City, and it was like Metal City drive you mad. Metal City ain't that bad, you know. It was like really, really basic
nice
stuff.
Rhyming.
Yeah. You know, I mean, like I said, you start off when you're in the beginning, and you don't know how to do stuff.
Yeah,
you just get better as you do it. You know, the more you write, the more you write, the better you get. And even like our last album.
Hmm.
I personally find it really difficult to write lyrics.
Hmm.
You know, I consider myself a pretty good one, but if you understood the process
get to that point, yeah.
To get from there to there, that's painful.
There's a lot of headaches.
Very painful, yeah. And I guess, those really early days was a lot of trial and error.
Yeah. How long since, I guess, from that moment of, you know, meeting Wayne on the train and then getting guys and going through a few different guitarists to try and get some stability. How long was it before you started playing those first few shows together? Like proper shows?
It was really quick.
Yeah.
You know, we I guess you could say we were pretty motivated, you know. In the early 80s, I used to go see bands like Boss, Lightning Rock, White Widow, you know, and for me, I'd always be up the front. I'd always wanted to sing in the mic, so I was singing along with them, you know.
Nice.
And that was exciting to me.
Yeah.
And wanting to be up there myself was like nothing was going to stop me.
Yeah.
You know, so the quicker we got there, the better. And I think it was from when I met Wayne to being on stage the first time, I think it was only like 6 or 8 months.
Yeah, wow, that's really quick.
Yeah. And we'd had probably 6 songs of our own by that time as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was quite
really quick. Did you have to, I mean, obviously you had been doing stuff with other musicians as well prior to meeting Wayne on the train. So did you have existing connections to get you those first few shows? Or how did you sort of network to try and get people to convince you to get onto a bill?
Getting shows back in 85 was like, it was almost impossible.
Yeah, right.
Because I mentioned Boss and White Widow and all of that. You'd probably class them as rock and roll now, but back then they were heavy metal.
Yeah, yeah.
And while they had pretty good followings and were getting regular gigs, trying to explain to agents and stuff, this new heavy metal is, you know, it's fast, it's exciting, it's, you know, they thought it was like punk.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And in those days, punk was kind of violent, but not in today's terms. Violence in today's terms is, you know, brutal.
Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
back then it was just fun violence.
High energy,
you know?
Sort of stuff. Yeah.
And trying to convince some agents to put us on a bill, that actually probably took a couple of months as well. We begged. We literally went down and got on our hands and knees, please, 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 just give us a shot. And I think our persistence paid off.
Yeah.
Because a lady named Diana Bailey, she ran an agency which she had the Seven Hills Inn and Sutherland Hotel. She had a couple of really good venues. And so, yep, she gave us a shot. We got on a bill. I think it was with Bronx and Lightning Rock. And I think were we first or were we second? I can't remember if we were first or second on. And, you know, I don't know if you've heard Bronx or Lightning Rock, but, yeah.
A little bit different.
Rock. And yeah. Here we were, a thrash metal band playing like Slayer or, you know, Stipe music. We all had studs and all leather and all sorts of stuff. And I think for someone who'd never seen that music, a lot of people probably looked at us and went, what the fuck? You know what I mean? It was probably a bit of a shock to the system, but we actually went down really well.
Yeah, cool.
You know, I think a lot of people got the same wow factor that we got when we heard Kill 'Em All. It was like, wow.
This is a thing.
Yeah, yeah. They hadn't really heard it. Yeah, so once they'd heard it live and really pumping out the system, they probably thought, wow, this is really high energy. This is good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we got that first gig. That was at the Royal Hotel at Sutherland. And I think we went to Diana again, this lady, and we said, well, what did you think? There was a pretty good crowd, wasn't there? Mm. Wasn't there, you know, like... You give us more gigs. And she didn't say yes straight away.
Yeah.
We had to keep being persistent again. And then after probably another month, we got some more gigs. Mm. And I think we got a headline straight up.
Yeah, wow.
And then we did a headline and I think there was something like 200-300 people there.
That's all right. That's pretty good. Which, really good.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you consider that awesome today, wouldn't you?
Yeah, definitely.
And back in those days, it was good, you know, like it wasn't super great if you filled a place, you know, like Seven Hills Inn back then probably would have held maybe 450, 500 people.
Right, okay.
So if you filled that place, you were doing really good. Yeah. And I think we filled that many times over sometimes.
Yeah.
But I think about our third gig, it was actually when I got married and I had to come back from my honeymoon. We were up at the Gold Coast because we got this gig playing with Escape.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And Escape in the day were, you know, one of the big bands, you know.
Yeah.
And I said to my wife, oh, we got to do it. This is really big, you know. It's Seven Hills Inn, you know, which I was born in Seven Hills.
That's
you know,
it.
Seven Hills Inn was my local.
That's it. Time to prove everything.
Half a kilometre from my house, you know.
Yeah, nice, yeah.
And so, yeah, the wife agreed. We came back from the honeymoon and we played this gig. It was like 480 people there. It was packed.
Nice.
It was absolutely packed. And I think from that gig on, we had a name for ourselves.
Going away after that. I mean, just from going from doing like either first or second band opening at that first show where you got a foot in the door to then, you know, the next gig or a couple of gigs later going to a headline spot, just, I guess, from the booking agent's point of view, I guess just throwing you out there to see how you do. I mean, that's a big step for you guys.
Well,
do you have a lot of friends and mates that sort of came out to really sort of help as much as you could in those early days?
Yeah, there was a lot of people in the scene, you know. Yeah. So there was a Parramatta scene, there was a Blacktown scene, and there was a mountain scene. There was, the mountains was, you know, Mick Burke, rest in peace, good fella. Steve Hughes, Tony Knoll, all those guys. That's where Slaughter Lord and all that sort of come from. And then there was the Blacktown scene, which was, you know, like us and the Addictive guys and, you know, that sort of group. And then when I moved from Seven Hills to Parramatta, there was also like a Parramatta group.
Yeah.
And then everyone sort of merged into Parramatta. There was Early Street, which was a house on Early Street and where... It was like just this drop-in centre. You'd go around there and at any one time there could be 30 people there.
Yeah, wow.
All metalheads. It was just a place to go.
Yeah.
Yeah, so then, you know, all those little scenes sort of built. I think in the 80s, you know, you walked down the street and you saw a guy wearing a metal shirt, you'd be like, oh, man, how you going? Yeah. You know, like these days it's nothing.
Not so much now,
But in those days, if you saw someone wearing a black shirt and it had a heavy metal band on it, you made friends with them.
Yeah.
You know, and you talked to them and, what do you do? You know, have you heard this band? Have you heard that band?
Half an hour later.
I guess it's the Facebook of today, you know. It was just you did it in person rather than, you know, with faceless people behind a keyboard, you know. So,
It's fun. I guess that's a big thing. So, I mean, for people that are listening that aren't from Sydney, when you talk about those two pubs to begin with, you've got Seven Hills and you've got Sutherland. Now, there's probably about, 35, 40 kilometres in between both places. And so Sydney's a big spread out place. So did you have people that would travel between these areas? It would have been hard to travel. People would have had to drive to get to these locations.
Well, those days you didn't have to worry about drinking and driving.
Yeah. So, it was a bit looser back then.
Yeah. But you had St. James Tavern as well. St. James Tavern was a really big, it was a big metal venue. Not quite sure if it exists today, but it used to be across the road from David Jones, down underneath.
Okay.
So you go downstairs, and it was a good vibe as well. So they were like probably three of the biggest metal type venues.
Yeah. So those guys that were sort of the Mountains Crew, Blacktown, and Parramatta, would those guys travel south to go to Sutherland as well?
Yeah, absolutely.
So they wouldn't just stick to their own area.
It was a day trip back
then. Yeah, absolutely. A big epic adventure just to get there.
Yeah, definitely.
Did Sutherland have their own scene? Because I lived in Sutherland for several years, and I've been to the Royal a few times for a few beers, and I just can't envision where and how bands played there. But obviously a completely different world.
A while back. I don't know if, you know, the people who were at that show were the locals. It's hard to say if they're locals, but I think a lot of them had just come from all over the place, you know. Probably not a lot of them, except our mates, had come to actually see us. They're probably there to see the other bands. But it didn't really take too long for us to get a following, because we were, at that time, we were the only ones that was playing that style of music.
Yeah.
And if you were like me, you know, that's the stuff you listen to, well, of course you're going to go along and see a band that played that style of music. You know, I would have done it if I wasn't in a band. So.
Yeah, definitely. And because you guys were pretty much the only band doing that style of music at the time, was that what made you guys stand out and potentially be in that right place, right time thing as far as luck and opportunity is concerned? I guess with those waves of what was happening in the US and I guess in Europe and whatnot.
Well, I mean, other bands quickly followed.
Yeah.
You know? So you can't really say that definitively. I mean, once we'd started doing a few shows, there were bands just coming out of the woodworks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can get a gig.
Yeah.
We can play. Yeah. So, look, maybe we opened a few doors for people. We did a lot of hard work, you know. It's one of those things where if we didn't get off our asses and do that hard work, we probably would have been like everyone else and wondering, well, where are we going to play or how are we going to do this, you know?
Yeah.
It's just we were just so motivated, so keen. We just wanted to play.
It's probably that groundswell of you guys opening up some doors and opening up the minds of people that like that same sort of music but never took the plunge to start a band. That's probably what gave you guys the reputation to get those next-level opportunities, whatever they may have been at the time.
Yeah, well, to get the next-level opportunities, And this came pretty quickly too. You had to have an album.
Yeah.
You know, we figured really early on that we got to write our own songs, let's do an album.
Mm.
And I think that came less than a year after we started. Like I think we were thinking about recording an album within the first year.
Wow.
And it was just after the first year. So we recorded it. By the time we recorded it and got it press, because we did it all ourselves.
Yep.
We had to pay for it all ourselves back in those days. There was no record labels even remotely interested in that style of music yet.
Mm.
And I say yet because once we did do that album, I think we put it out in mid-June or July 86.
Okay, yep.
And then we started sending it out to everyone. You know, in 85, 86, Metal Forces was the Bible of metal, you know. If you wanted to know something, you wanted to know all the bands, you picked up Metal Forces from Utopia and you you know, you read it.
And that's how you would have found out about Kill 'Em All and Metallica and all the stuff that's happening overseas as well.
Yeah. And yeah, it pretty much, like, if you were talking to someone who said, oh, did you see this band in Metal Forces? You know.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it was that kind
of
thing.
It was just part of the conversation.
There were other magazines. There was Kerrang and what's that other one? There was another couple of big ones, English ones. And the first thing that we decided to do was send the LP to some of the record stores in England.
Mm.
I don't know why. We just thought...
Just why not? Give it a go.
Have a listen to this, you know. And straight away, like, the first lot that we sent to Shades Records in England, Shades was the biggest... Everything happened in Shades, you know. It was like Utopia for Sydney. You know, if you're into metal, you went there. You just went there to socialise or whatever. But Shades was probably 20 times bigger, that's all.
Yeah, right.
And in London, so 20 times more population.
Absolutely.
So anyway, we sent it over there. They open it up. They put it on. They crank it up. Some guy walks through the store, says, oh, is this the new Metallica album? And it happened to be the head honcho for Polygram Records.
Not
so
bad.
So when you talk about luck, that's luck.
Yeah. As you said before, playing shows and not knowing who's in front of you while you're playing.
Yeah.
You can play in front of 10 people, but you need one
those,
person.
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So the record's playing in Shades Record Shop, and Dave Thorne from Phonogram Records walks in and says, is this the new Metallica album? You know, so, I mean, it was at the time when Ride the Lightning was supposed to be released.
Mm-hmm. And, good timing.
And that's timing. That's, you know, had that not happened, we...
Who knows?
God knows what could have happened.
So, okay, so this guy walks into the store, asks a question, finds out it's you guys. I mean, back then, how did word get back to you? Did they write a letter?
I had my phone number. I put... Mega Metal Productions, PA Box, whatever it was, 6 something, Parramatta, and then the phone number.
Yeah, right.
My home phone number on the bloody, on the album.
Nice.
So I get this phone call, and actually I got two phone calls. I got a phone call from England. I got a phone call from MCA Records in America.
Wow.
But the English one come first, And so I answered this phone. I think it was late at night or something, you know, obviously because they're the other side of the world. And he says, oh, is that Matt Moore? And I said, yeah, it is. Who's this? He goes, oh, this is David Thorne from Phonogram Records in London. I go,
what?
Like, silence. And I had to process it in my brain. And I said, from which record company? He goes, from Phonogram. And I'm trying to think, do I know Phonogram?
Yeah.
No, I didn't know Phonogram. Actually, no, I'm sorry, I lied. Because Metallica were... No, hang on, that came later.
So,
They came later. It was Megaforce at first, but Music for Nations, sorry. But, I'd heard of him from maybe Black Sabbath or somewhere.
Yeah.
It was something like that. So, yeah, I'm processing this in my head and I'm thinking, Dave Thorne from Phonogram Records, is this for real or is this someone just bullshitting me or is this someone playing a joke? So anyway, I heard him out, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, how you going? What's happening? What's going on?
Wow.
Oh, you know, I was walking through Shades Record the other day and they were playing your record and blah, 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 blah. And he says, we'd be really interested in this record. Another bit of long silence and I'm processing in my head thinking, fuck, Phonogram Records in London wants to put our album out. Fuck. So, yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah, like one of those things that you, like, one in a lifetime opportunity that you kind of think, I don't deserve it. Yeah, maybe we do deserve it. You know, like, you just don't know how to process something like that. And so several phone calls later, we had a contract on our table. And he actually flew out to Australia.
Really?
Yeah. He came out to see us. We played at the Seven Hills Inn one night. It was the middle of winter. I can't remember which gig it was, but he was there and we were in Paul, the guitarist's ute driving around and he's sitting in the back of the ute holding onto the top and it was freezing cold. We were shivering. Because he was from England, you know, he probably didn't feel it, but, you know, here's this record executive in the back of a ute driving
Welcome
around
to Australia,
with Morton Soon and Seven Hills Inn.
Wow.
How funny.
Yeah, so...
Was he around the same age as you guys, a bit older?
No,
or?
I mean, on the phone, he sounded like a 55-year-old.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that I know what a 55... No. I'm 55 now, so what is a 55-year-old? But he sounded like an older fella. But when we actually met him, yeah, he was... Like, we were 20, in our mid-20s at the time, so maybe he was late 20s, early 30s yeah, okay. or something. It was yeah. hard to say
because
his voice sounded like much older.
Yeah, yeah.
And, yeah, when we met him, it was a bit of a spin out. So, yeah, it, like I said, luck. Were we destined for that to happen? I don't know.
Mm.
Were we just in the right place at the right time? I don't know. Did we work our butts off and all that just happened as a reason of us working our butts off?
Mm.
I don't know.
Mm.
But, you know, it's probably a combination of everything.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, it can't be just one thing. And I guess that goes back to that first question I asked about what separated you guys. And it's just a number of different factors, stuff that was probably in your control as far as your hard work. And,
well, look, if and you, you've got to have the music first.
Yeah.
You know, I've had young kids send me CDs, give me CDs, you know, and, oh, have a listen to this and tell me what you think.
Mm.
And I'm like, do you really want me to tell you what I think? If you want me to tell you what I think, then live with that.
Yeah.
Because if I think it's shit, I'm going to tell you it's shit.
Yeah.
If I think it's great, I'll tell you it's great. Mm. If I think your production's shit, I'll tell you it's shit.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I think, I don't know why, but we just had these songs that kind of worked.
Yeah.
You know, I've always said Mortal Sin was a pop metal band. You know, I mean, the way I wrote choruses, I wrote them in a repetitive pop kind of way. Yeah. But it made them memorable. It Absolutely. Made them catchy, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Creator's one of my all-time favourite bands.
Yeah.
And when you listen to choruses of Creator, it's just da-da-da, da-da. It's That's simple, right. yeah. very simple, because it's people sing along.
That's right, yeah.
So my idea is if I can get anyone who walk out of our gig or listen to our record singing our song or whistling a tune, That's our it. Job's done.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, but in saying that, you don't want them to forget quickly. And, you know, having albums now that are 30 years old and people still talking about them.
Absolutely.
I think there's something
it's
there.
It's timeless.
Yeah. yeah. You can't sort of get away with shit songs and still have them be memorable. You know?
I think people lose touch with that when they're putting together songs, like whether you're young or you've been doing it for a few years, and they sort of think, they're not thinking about how it's going to be listened to in 10 years time or 20 years time or 30 years time,
no.
because they're just thinking about now
yeah.
and trying to use that as, you know, a product to try and get an opportunity. But really, I mean, if you're writing for the long term, you're sort of thinking, is this something that I love?
But you don't write for the long term.
Well, you guys didn't, I guess. You just wanted to make people enjoy what you're doing.
Well, you know, the process for me is being the lyric writer. I won't say songwriter because everyone's a songwriter, but to be the lyric writer is a couple of things. You're either trying to get a message across, trying to be melodic,
yep.
or you're trying to just be yourself and enjoy yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then if you can get all those three together, hopefully you've got a song that people are going to enjoy. Yep. I don't know why people enjoy our songs. You just could not possibly analyse the reasons. Because if you ask Joe, what do you like about our songs, he'll give you a different reason to what Paul does and what Andy does. Or, you know, everyone's
got a different...
Yeah, everyone's got a different connection to a song.
Yeah.
But if you can create that connection, then you're well on your way.
Yeah.
You know, and our first album, Mayhem and Destruction, was a lot of satanic kind of songs, you know. I wouldn't have called myself a writer back then. I only part-time wrote. Wayne wrote a lot of the songs because I didn't know how to write.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was still learning. Mm. But he was just someone who could write anything, you know. I mean, I don't smoke cones.
You know? It could be a different element there that's helping him.
So, but, you know, for someone who smokes cones all the time, your ideas are coming out million times a minute. But I didn't, you know, and it was a lot harder for me.
Yeah.
But once I'd read his lyrics, then I would just change him a bit to suit how I wanted to sing him, you know, because he was more of a storyteller, but same as me, didn't completely know how to write a song, you know, or or someone who's a singer and has someone who's not a singer writes some words for them, they don't get the nuances. You know, they don't understand. I need to breathe there. Hello, hello. Yeah. I need to take a breath in between those two lines. Hello, So sometimes it's just a matter of me tweaking some of his lyrics and going, oh, I want it to be rhythmic. And I knew some parts of the feeling. I had a lot of feeling rather than technicality. And I think a lot of people did too. Like when I sit and listen to Lebanon now, like where the fuck does that dun 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 come from? It doesn't even fit, but it fits.
It does. It's
because it was feeling. Yeah. We wrote to feeling. We just wrote what we felt was right.
It's not this calculated thing that you try to structure out. It's just
musicians
out.
Of today would go, oh no, that's the time. You know all this. We didn't know it at the time, but we were kind of like a prog thrash metal band as well because the way we wrote, and especially when Mick came into the band, Mick loved his prog. Back then, before prog came big, before Dream Theater and all that sort of stuff, he'd already had in his head, you know, that the different riffs, you know, like one song, 35 different riffs, part one, part two, part three. But it all just fitted so well, And we didn't want to, when we were writing thrash, we didn't want to, like, really copy anyone.
Yep.
You know, everyone said, oh, Immortal Sin, you sound like Metallica. What? Why? How do we sound like fucking Metallica? Mm. Come on.
You're playing thrash, that's about it.
Yeah. And maybe because my voice sounded a little bit similar. But I didn't want that.
Mm.
You know, I take it as a compliment, but I wanted to be Matt Mora. I didn't want to be fucking James Hetfield. Who wants to be James Hetfield?
That's it. He's a clone. Yeah.
So when we did our next album, you know, there was a lot more thought put into it. A lot more thought into the lyrics.
You knew who you guys were by that. Well, a little bit more of what you were and what you'd been doing. You had a bit more experience.
We didn't really have a lot more experience because we were still sort of, we were still in Australia. You know, we were hoping that we'd get over to the UK and Europe and America with our first album, but the record company was a bit, no, you're not ready, which pissed me off something to no end, you know, like we had opportunities, you know, get on tour with Anthrax, get on tour with Testament. So in 1987, you had Mortal Sin, Testament, Death Angel, you know, there was a lot of bands that were all kind of along the same level. But by 1989, when we brought out Face of Despair, Testament were up there.
Yeah.
Death Angel were up there. And Mortal Sin was still down here.
Yeah.
Because we didn't tour.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the essence of becoming big is you got to play.
Yeah.
And you got to play international gigs.
So you think that was a big factor which sort of held the band back a bit? Is that absolutely. They didn't let you off the leash to get you overseas?
Even to this day, you know, like if, dare I say it, if you consider Mortal Sin in all of those bands, we're still way down here. And I don't know why. I don't know why. The music's just as good, surely. But why? Because they're there.
Yeah.
They're where the scene is. They're all those bands are constantly touring Europe, constantly touring America, and we constantly toured Australia.
Yeah.
It's like
down the arse end of the world.
Yeah, yeah. And the population of Australia is, you know, 23, 24
now. A couple of cities in Europe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for us to tour even just the East Coast, to do Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide,
massive.
You could have gone from London to Vladivostok, in that time and played 40 shows. For instance, our last tour that we did, the 2011 Thrashfest Classics, we did 26 shows in 26 days, 40,000 kilometres we travelled. Because it crisscrossed. It didn't just go city to city to city to city to city.
Bounced back and forth.
Yeah, we did city there, city over there, 12 hours away, and then went back to city over there, which was only 5 minutes from over that one over there.
Just the way that they landed. Yeah,
that's the way they did it. Because even in Europe, you can get crowded out. I think the scene over there, like for us Aussies, if we went, because Annalise went and lived in Holland. What do you call it?
Netherlands.
Netherlands. And for them, it was like, wow, we can go see a gig every night of the week.
I know, it's incredible.
But for the locals, it's like, ugh.
Yeah. I remember that years ago, we were in Europe, and this is when Dungeon was still around, and they did a tour with Megadeth, and it was Stuttgart, and it was pretty full, but it wasn't sold out. And we were talking to a couple of the locals, and they're like, oh, Blind Guardian played here the night before, and in 2 nights' time, it's something like Creator or somebody else. This is like, and we know Megadeth will be back in 6 months' time or 12 months' time, so we'll just see them next time.
They've got to pick around. And choose.
It's a sport for choice.
I guess we're kind of like that here in Australia too, you know.
Getting like that now.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I didn't even know, but Winterson played
last night. Yeah.
You know, and then Steel Assassins was on the same night. And that's the thing. You've got to, do I go see Winterson or do I go see Steel Assassins? You know, or do I just stay home?
Yeah.
You know, and it has become pretty blasé these days. I mean, I won't say I've got an excuse or anything, but, you know, with my wife in a wheelchair, I'm dedicated now to looking after her. So going on
different priorities as
family's first priority. Yeah. But going to a gig, I've got to prepare, and if I do go, she's stuck in a chair all night until I get home, basically.
Yeah.
So, you know, but when you sit and you wonder why everyone else is not going out, they've probably all got their own reasons as well. Absolutely. You know, their money reasons, they're probably, like we just said, you know, I can go see them next week or whatever. But, you know, when we were first playing, the Australian rock scene was really big in the mid-'80s. You know, like you could go see In Excess at the Family Inn. You could go see Cold Chisel.
Yeah, Cold Chisel. Yeah,
Radio. The scene here was really big. Angels, Rose Tattoo, all of those bands were playing.
Mm.
And we come onto the market, you know, And I guess, like, the competition sort of, while we weren't really fighting for the rock market, we're still fighting for the punter.
That's it, yeah.
You know?
Fighting for the attention.
Yeah, and bands like In Excess and that, when they come to Sydney, they played 4 nights a week or 5 nights a week. You know, I used to go see Boss 3 nights a week.
Wow.
If they were playing here.
It's a residency.
Yeah. You know, you'd go to Punch Bowl one night, you go to the Family, or you go to Enmore, the Boulevard Hotel, you know, like in them days, there were pubs everywhere.
Yeah.
So you could go on a pub crawl in the city on a Saturday night, and you could start at Central and head your way to the Cross, and there'd be 15 venues with the Angels were there. They were, you know, like Midnight Oil, you had such choice.
Yeah.
But I guess with rock and with pop, there's a million fans.
It's a bigger market for it.
Yeah, it's a bigger market. So with metal, you had to create the niche, you know, and going back to where we were in the beginning, Mortal Sin kind of, I won't say we created the niche, but I'll say we, you know, we were one of the bands that started the niche.
And it would have been fresh for a lot of people because, as you said earlier on, like people either had heard about this type of music from overseas, but there was never anything local.
Yeah.
And suddenly their eyes have been open and ears have been opened up to this music and going, wow, like this is high energy. It's so different to what else I'm seeing around the place. So
that would have definitely helped. And plus, you know, Australia had never had, in 85, 86, leading into 87, we'd never had any international bands come here.
Yeah.
So, okay, when we first heard Metallica in 84, it took I'll start the story. In 87, Megadeth were meant to come to Australia.
Mm.
And it was like, what? You know, everyone was like, wow, we're finally going to get an international band. Today, it's like, you got a choice of 36 bands coming over. You know, but in 87, now the tour didn't happen.
Mm.
It ended up just not happening. You know, false start, you know, trying to get a band like that over here. It was whatever the reason, it just didn't happen. So it wasn't until 89, really, that we finally got someone of note, which was the Metallica tour.
Yeah.
Justice for All. So, you know, we were lucky because we were label mates.
Yeah, Metallica, I was just going to say.
We got the gig, you know, and in 89, so between 85 and 89, that's 4 years, there was hundreds of thrash bands around, hundreds of metal bands. So, you know, to get that gig, again, we were lucky because we were label mates.
Yeah.
You know, we just got we just got the gig. Yeah. We didn't even have to ask for it. We just got it.
Yeah.
It was kind of a given. You know, oh, we're label mates. We need to get that gig.
Yeah.
But, you know, and...
How'd you find out? Did the label contact you and tell you, or was it the local promoter, or...?
Look, there were many, many phone calls to England. I spent many 3 a.m. phone calls to England, you know, dropping hints. And, you know, we're going to get it, aren't we? We're going to get it. And they, you know, we'll do this. It's a plan. And your new album will be released right around. And they're trying to say, you know, not tell us, but they were telling us.
Yeah.
You know, your new album's going to drop around that time and all this. So it was a given, but like... When they finally said, yes, Your Honour, it was like, winning the lotto.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We just jumped through the roof. And, that tour, I mean, if you ask any metalhead what's the best metal show you've ever been to, 99% of them will say Metallica first tour, you know?
Yeah.
So it was just one of those memorable moments that you could never forget.
So, was obviously, I mean, the band themselves obviously was defining in itself, but to play those sort of venues and those sort of crowds, was that the first time you guys had really sort of played sizes that big?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what sort of crowds you've played in front of, but when you...
Not like that.
But when, like, Horton Pavilion in the 80s was 8,500 people.
Yeah.
Today it's only 5,500.
Yeah, it's less, yeah.
And to see that place just going off, like totally off, and all the things that happened on that day, the riots out the front, the TV cameras there, and it was just one of the... like, if you weren't there, you wouldn't believe it.
Yeah.
You know, if someone said... told you the story, you'd be going, yeah, right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's kind of gone down in folklore these days. And when people talk about it, you know, the older guys talk about it, it's like, man, that was so
it's good. Probably one of the most talked about stories as far as, like, shows. For me, being, I've lived in Sydney for almost 15 years now, and just going to metal gigs and just talking to guys, and they're just going, and as you said, like, when people talk about the show, or in the most memorable shows they've ever been to, that is always one that gets talked about all the time. And as you said, it's folklore. It's become this thing that's just bigger than life.
Yeah, well, the funny thing was, like, it was the first time Metallica had come out here. So, you know, and they'd already had Kill 'Em All, Master of Puppets, Ride the Lightning. It already been, you know, so there'd been so many albums. They were already up to their fourth album plus the, you know, the EP, Garage Days. So, you know, it was like, about time. You know, there was 5-6 albums and you'd hadn't come to Australia. So the anticipation was so high.
Mm.
And it was really the first big show.
Yeah.
The first big show. And, like, when we got to Melbourne and we played Festival Hall, you know, again, it was packed to the rafters. It was just completely nuts. And... when we went on, the crowd just started chanting, Mortal Sin, Mortal Sin, Mortal Sin. And it was so fucking loud. And I was so nervous. So I just said to the guys, I've got to go to the toilet. I've got to go to the toilet. So I go to the toilet and have a leak. And there's this guy there going, he didn't know who I was.
Mm.
And he says, who the fuck does this band think they are? Like,
yeah.
You know, and I'm the singer and I've just walked in the toilet and I've heard this guy grumbling under his guts that, the support band's getting, like, the whole crowd's singing for him. And so I come out of the toilet and I just said to the guys, this is good. This is really fucking good,
That's
cool. And Lars Ulrich was standing behind Wayne's drum kit. You know, like, go, go, go. Oh, they were really pumped up. Nothing can compare to that.
And, I mean, this is before, I mean, they were a big band by that stage, but they hadn't exploded to that next level again.
I think that tour was close. The explosion. Yeah. I think because if you go back and look at the tour dates for Justice for All, they toured for 2.5 years on that record.
I guess that's enough to show that they had a demand just to keep touring that long before that next album came out, which obviously was just next level again.
Well, in saying that, it wasn't their first arena.
No.
You know, but it was their first big tour. Maybe by the time they got to the Black Album, they did, I think they still did 2.5 years touring for that.
Oh, I think so,
yeah. But it was arenas.
Yeah,
absolutely. So, you know, yeah, they went from super level to
mega, you know, yeah,
mega,
crazy.
Mega awesome level, yeah.
Were they down to earth kind of guys at that stage? Like, were they, yeah. Was how approachable were they? Or did you not really get a lot of time to talk to them? Or what was the dynamic like with these guys?
Well, it's one of the, we were fanboys,
yeah.
You know, so it was, how do you approach these people, these mega stars, you know? But yeah, they were mostly good. I mean, I remember I got a lot of shit signed. I took everything. Sign this. But I never got anything signed by Kirk Hammett.
Oh, really? Okay.
He was never there.
Oh.
So
okay.
In saying, were they all approachable? Yes, but where was Kirk?
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
I don't know. I don't know. Did he have a wife there? I don't know. Mm. But when after the, was it that first show? No, it was the next time they come around. I was going to say we went and partied with Jason down at the Siebel.
Cool. Like
3-4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, nice.
After the second tour, playing guitar, singing songs, passing cones around. You know, yeah. Approachable, absolutely.
Yeah,
you
know.
But then, in saying that, when they come out for Big Day Out 2006.
Oh, okay, yeah.
All right, I was working on the show, and I had a pass that let me into the dressing rooms and stuff. And I'd gone in there, I'd had to go and take something to someone, and James was there talking to someone. And so I stood and waited till the conversation finished, and he walks off. Conversation finished and he walked off.
Oh.
And I'm like, James. He's turned around and he goes, I go, oh, I'm Matt from Mortal Sin. We toured you guys the first time around. He goes, oh, hey, man.
No.
You know, like, I was so bummed.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people have said, you know, sometimes meeting your idol can be the best thing in life, or it can be the worst thing in life, you know. Yeah. And but that was only just one experience.
And I
understood. That's cool. No, I just want to say good day, man. It's all good.
Go
back to what you were, you know, like, if it's such a strange thing having someone come up to you in the street and saying hello.
Yeah.
Oh, man, how you going? Yeah, you know, it's like, you don't expect that. It's not something that you, when you took up music, that's not what you, you know, it's not really something that you expect. But it is a weird thing, you know. I still don't get used to it.
Yeah.
You know, and especially when they're drunk people and they're like, yeah, man, I saw you guys with Megadeth at the Emo, and I'm like, yeah, I wasn't in the band at that time. I don't ever say it, but cool.
I was going to say, like, you mentioned one of your favourite bands is Creator, so you would have seen them when they just recently came out. So no doubt you would have had a couple of guys throughout the night that bow you up and...
I try and be inconspicuous, you know. I sit behind the desk, you know, like head down and just banging away. But I don't know. I'm not naturally like you would expect a front man to be over the top. Hey, you know, be a really what do they call it? An out there type of person.
Yeah, like an extrovert. Extrovert.
I'm not. I'm the opposite. Yeah. I'm always the guy that stands at the back.
That's probably why.
You look at a lot of early Mortal Sin photos. I'm always at the back. It's Wayne or someone at the front. Like nothing wrong with that. But I didn't care for the attention.
Yeah.
You know, I was two different people. Yeah. Off stage, I was Matt Mora. On stage, I was Mortal Sin Matt Mora.
Yeah.
Which was a totally different person.
That's probably why you did so well on stage as well, because you had... You almost had that ticket to have that different persona.
Yeah, you got a license to
exhaust yourself all the time.
And I mean, that's what got me into singing. I mean, if I take it right back, 72, 73, 74, Freddie Mercury was my idol.
Yeah, right.
You know,
yeah, cool.
And to look at him as a front man, you know, flamboyant. I'm just looking at him going, oh, I got to be a singer.
Yeah.
Again, it's just one of those things. But when I finally got on stage, I didn't know how to act. I didn't know how to hold a mic. I was like,
what do you do when you're not singing?
What do you do? Yeah. So I had to figure all that out.
Yeah.
And just a totally different person. So you know, you see me in the street. Yes, I'm Matt Mora, but I'm I'm not necessarily that same guy.
Yeah, energetic person on stage. Yeah, definitely.
It's weird to say that, but... Well,
but, I mean, it's a hard thing for a lot of people to try and maintain that. And some people try to do it. Some people try to have that same energy when they're off the stage and they just burn out because you're trying to meet expectations of what people perceive you as when they see you perform. And so they expect you to be at that level all the time, even if you're just sitting in a pub or you're walking down the street with your shopping or something.
Yeah, well, look, I'm lucky enough nowadays that most people have realised that that's
you.
Yeah, you know, I'm approachable. I'll talk to people. Mm. You know, sometimes you just want to get away from them, but, you know, it's rude. I figure that's rude. You know, like I said, you know, with the James Hetfield thing, I thought, you rude fucker. It's like one of your fans is just wait. I waited like half an hour for you to finish your conversation and you just fucking walked away.
Yeah.
You know, like I'll try and be approachable all the time and you know, if someone wants a photo, yep, no probs. Mm. But, you know, there's a line between where it becomes an intrusion. I just want to enjoy the show, man. You know, I want to watch creator too. You know what I mean? But I guess when, you know, if you do become someone who's, you know, I hate using that euphemism, well known or something,
Like
that. But if everyone knows you, well, you've got to expect that someone might come up and say hello.
That's it. And you got to deal with the consequences of however you choose to act. And you don't have to be on all the time. You don't have to always be friendly. I mean, you're you. And it's who you are in that moment. But whatever you decide to do in that time, well, you've got to deal with whatever those consequences are. If you happen to be in a bad mood and you want to be a rude prick, or if you just want to just do the basic pleasantries and just keep moving, I mean, it's up to that person. But, it's a hard thing. And it's a hard thing for people because, you know, you idolise people and you see them in a certain light. And then, as you said before, sometimes, I mean, I'm the same. I'm so reluctant to meet, like, particular idols because I'm scared that I'm just going to get them on the wrong day. And then that will be in my mind afterwards whenever I listen to that music. I'm going, oh, God, that experience. Like, that person was just not happy that day, didn't want to borrow me.
Well, look, I'll say this. I've met a lot of famous people.
Yeah.
And at work, at least, I just go, hey, man.
Yeah. That's it.
Because I understand, you know, and I know, you know, okay, if it's in a gig mode and they're partying, you might take that opportunity to talk a little bit more, but it's like, hey man, there you go.
You got to understand their context of what they're in and what they're doing at that stage. Where are they? What are they about to do?
Yeah. Well, you might be sitting in a restaurant and you look across, oh, there's Jamie Drury.
Yeah.
So what? You're not so what, but it's like you acknowledge and you leave it.
That's it. There's a time and a place.
Yeah, there's a time and a place, and I think there's been some really, really funny sort of experiences. One time I was in I rarely go to Utopia these days. You know, it's just one of those things. But I went with Annalise one time, and there was this young girl. I think it was Paul Murphy might have said something, because I don't think she actually knew who I was, but Paul or someone said, oh, that's Matt from Mortal Sin. And she was just like, she was dumbstruck, and she came up and she was talking and everything. She was a bass player. So, make sure you practice and you learn everything, do all your theory.
Yeah.
But I was trying to help her.
Encourage her,
this, as you said, time and place, it was kind of weird, but I went with it, and hopefully encouraged her, and hopefully she's out there playing now.
That's it. Oh, well, there you go. I mean, that's probably the one of the benefits of being in a band where you've got people that appreciate what you're doing. You can have an influence on other people. You can leave a good impact and have those opportunities when everything lines up and it's the right place, right time, of course. But going back a couple of steps, and you're talking about, you know, the delays in getting to Europe and whatnot. I mean, you guys eventually, when you did get there, you did some pretty good tours over there.
Yeah.
Did you find that there were certain pockets in Europe, so to speak, you know, focusing on Europe, that the band did exceptionally well compared to other areas? Was Germany a big one for you guys?
Yeah, probably Germany.
Yeah.
And mainly because of Creator and that. I think German fans are a lot like Australian fans.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to sort of put them in the same bracket, but as far as reaction and everything, you could tell You know, you get different reactions everywhere you go. You know, when we played in England, it was, I won't say somber, but it was, the energy level was a lot lower then. God, we played one show in Poland on the last tour. It was scary.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, wow. I was in the dressing room before we went on, and I think someone, no, it was after we played. Just got carried out, blood all over his face. It was just, I couldn't believe how much blood there was. I'm like, fuck, what happened to him? Oh, just stage dive. Hit the floor, broke his nose, broke his face, blood everywhere. You know, like...
No sweat.
Yeah. It reminded me of 86, 87. Yeah, yeah. But this was 2011.
Yeah.
You know, in Poland. And there was chicks in the mosh pit, like, doing circle pits and...
That's crazy.
Smashing people. Like, wow. Yeah. So, I love it. You know, different countries, different reactions, different energy levels.
Because I think... sort of in the later years for you guys were signed to AFM? No, Armageddon. Was it Armageddon? In the piece?
Armageddon.
For a little bit?
For one album, and then, what was it? Metal Blade. No, not Metal Blade. Noise.
Were they German as well? Because Armageddon were German, weren't they?
Yeah. They're the guys that are in... that run Wacken.
Oh, so Thomas Jensen. Yeah. I think just the amount of times I've gone to Germany over the years and you go to...
Listen to him. I think I've been twice, both on tours.
Yeah, but it's just, I mean, I see people wearing battle jackets and they've got little sim patches, and then you talk to someone and they're like, where are you from? I said, from Australia. And they're like, oh, and they rattle off all these bands. Mortal Sin's always in the conversation. And it's so... Germany's just so noticeable when it comes from that connection with you guys. And even now when, you know, you can
probably
see...
Probably because we've played more shows in Germany than anywhere else.
So that's where you have most of your presence there, in Germany, But it seems to be, I mean, we were talking earlier about Desecrator and the guy sending you a photo of a picture of you guys in Gothenburg. But Desecrator have got that, I think they've got that, they come from a similar cut to you guys as far as ethic, the approach of, you know, different style a little bit, but they come from a similar sort of cut, and they seem to be doing really well. I mean, they're playing with Airborne at the moment, so they've got great crowds, but Germany seems to be really sort of lapping.
But there's a lot of good Aussie bands that are doing, you know, like even Elm Street as well.
Yeah, Elm Street are doing really good.
Yeah, and I think, you know, they probably didn't learn anything from us, but you're right, they come from the same cut. They all have the motivation, they all have the desire, I just want to be on stage.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, because we, like, even now, when I go watch a band, I pine to be on stage.
Yeah.
You know, I long to be on the stage, but I know I can't. Mm. And it's just one of those things. I think when it's in your blood, that's all you want to do.
Yeah,
you know, if you like horses, you want to be a jockey.
Yeah,
you know, if you like anything, if you've got that passion for something, you just
go for it.
Yeah, you're just close-minded to anything else, and you just, that's what I want to do, that's what I'm going to do, nothing's going to stop me.
Total focus.
If you've got that attitude, you'll make it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's why a lot of these bands are now getting a lot of shows. You know, in on our last tours, we really struggled to get shows.
Mm.
And I, for the life of me, could not figure out, why would you not want Mortal Sin on your shows? Was it because you thought we might ask too much money?
Mm.
And we were only asking like two grand a show, which is fuck all. Mm. It doesn't even cover your airfares.
Nah.
But we were thinking, maybe they were thinking we're 20, 25, 30. I don't know.
You
know, we really struggled to get on shows, and I couldn't put my finger on why.
Mm.
Mm. Fuck, we'll play for nothing. You know, we just want to fucking play.
That's it. Yeah.
It was really tough. You know, there was one year we went to Europe twice in one year, and it fucking cost us a shitload of money.
Yeah.
You know, we spent easy $50,000 to $80,000.
Yeah, big dollars.
Albeit we did get one of the tours was paid for by International Pathways. Have you heard of that?
Yes, yep.
Yeah, we got 20 grand out of them for one tour.
Oh, that's pretty good.
The only reason why we went the second time, but, you know, it didn't cover everything.
No, no.
I think
you guys did South America as well.
Yeah, that was only really small. Yeah. That was, we were getting 500 a show.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, $500 a show.
Yeah.
It was more for the, you know, oh, wow, South America.
You can tick that off the list. Yeah, you play
tick,
there.
Yeah, tick the boxes.
Was that another world altogether again? As far as crowds and whatnot?
Yeah.
Because that was with Overkill, wasn't it?
No.
No, that was on your own?
Yeah.
Yeah,
we did that on our own. The first show we played in Santiago in Chile, I had people coming up in tears, crying, saying, thank you, man. Thank you for coming to our town. Thank you. Fucking we love you. We love you. Yeah.
Just been waiting.
And, like, yeah. Yeah. So you know, when it was like when Metallica came to Australia the first time. Yeah. I was like, oh, wow. We've got this big band coming to Australia. But for them, it was just like they probably thought they'd never, ever get to see Mortal Sin. Yeah. He was Mortal Sin playing in Santiago
or yeah.
you know, whatever. And, yeah, it was probably 450 people there.
Yeah.
They sang every fucking word.
That's cool.
Every fucking nice. Song. And I'm like, how do you guys even know us? You know, you're right. It's a whole nother world. And you just, when you write music, you just don't expect that shit. You know, you hope for it. You know, you write something and you hope someone will like it.
Yep.
But when they do, it's almost overwhelming, you know. It's like when we played Wacken Festival the second time or even the first time. The first time was 2006 and we played in the tent. Mm. That tent never gets filled.
Mm.
Like they had to stop people from coming in, you know, and it was the mosh pit at the front was just all dirt.
Yeah.
At the end of the gig, we were covered in dirt.
Yeah.
We would, like, we had to clean guitars, and I'd blow my nose for 2 days afterwards.
It's still
dirt was still coming out because
just blowing up into the air.
The whole room was like, if you see photos or videos of in there, all you could see is like a smog in front of the lights, but it was fucking dirt.
Yeah,
you know, because everyone was just going off. But the second time, we were first on 12 midday.
Mm.
You'd think, oh, fuck, we're going to play in front of a couple of hundred people.
Yeah, yeah.
50, 60,000 people.
So good.
Yeah, you know, like, really? It's like you were partying until 4 a.m. and you're back here at 12? Fuck, I love you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, and when, okay, not everyone was there to see Mortal Sin. No way. Maybe you're the first 200 in the front.
Doesn't matter. Yeah, but
everyone was there fucking fist pumping. And
everyone's having a good time.
Yeah, it was just... Man, like, I don't know. That's what I live for.
I spoke about it earlier about, you know, music being timeless and, you know, even bands that, you know, before you guys, that people still spin and play regularly and often and it's become part of culture. And for you guys, you've had music out there for decades now. From you personally, how do you keep that legacy going for the band as far as people just being aware of it? Obviously, the music out there and does its own thing, but are you conscious of that? Because obviously the band's not existing now, but I guess for you and just having that music out there, is there anything that you sort of keep in mind, or is it just the case that the music's out there, it's been released and people just enjoy it?
Look, to be honest, it's not the band that keeps the legacy going. It's the fans.
Yeah, definitely. You know,
and so long as they still remember, there'll always be a legacy.
Yeah.
I often wonder, you know, will there be a time when it's all forgotten?
Yeah.
I keep the Mortal Sin Facebook page going. I don't post a lot of stuff, you know. But it's just one of those things where, going back to the music, if the music lasts the time, then the legacy will also last. Yes, you know, and maybe again that luck thing comes into it. We were lucky. We were just one of the first.
Mm.
You know, it's easy to remember the first.
Mm.
It's not, you know, like. Who played in last year's grand final of football?
Oh, fucking me.
Yeah, you don't remember stuff like that.
Yeah.
But with music, you remember.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because what you grew up with, you know, I grew up with ABBA and Queen and all those stuff.
It's that nostalgic thing.
Yeah,
is,
yeah. But I also had older brothers who were listening to Pink Floyd, Hawkwind, Budgie even.
Yeah, you know, right,
like bands like
nice.
That. So I was lucky enough to be exposed to music very early.
Hmm.
I went to see AC/DC in 1975 or something.
What was that like?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Was I in 75, I was 13. So,
yeah.
You know, how old were you when you went to your first gig?
Oh, no, I probably would have been, around that, 12, 11, 12, 13. Yeah.
And it's those early years that are so impressionable. Yeah, they stick in your mind, and you always remember when you live it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was reading the Metallica autobiography.
Oh, yeah.
The is it called Enter Night or something?
The recent one that they put out not too long ago. Yeah.
And I'm reading it, but I'm reading it from a perspective. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember that. Yeah. And they're talking about things like with Metal Forces and all this. I go, yeah. Because I lived through that time.
Yeah.
But how old are you?
33.
So that's another generation down from me.
Yeah.
Annalise is 29. Yeah. So, you know.
Similar, yeah.
People of a different generation are reading it from a historical perspective, whereas I'm reading it from...
You were there.
I was there, yeah. Yeah. Like I remembered all of that happening, mainly because of Metal Forces.
Yeah.
You know, the Metal Forces magazine, if you went and picked them all up now, you'd pretty much be documenting the history of thrash metal and any other style of metal. Yeah, so it's a whole other thing when you live through it all.
Mm.
You know, you might have parents or grandparents talk to you, oh, you know, I was in the war and all this. They're reliving it all.
Yeah.
They're telling the story because that was the impression
that's part of their life. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It's the same with music.
Yeah.
You know, you'll always remember what got you started. You'll always remember if you're in a band, you'll always remember the guitarist that inspired you. You'll always remember the singer that inspired you.
It's definitely. I mean, it gives me motivation with us still playing and writing music and putting music out there that, I mean, for us, you release an album, and if you've had a couple of albums beforehand, everyone goes, it's not as good as the last album or the album beforehand. And then eventually in 2 or 3 years' time, when you've released another couple of albums, they go, it's not as good as that album that you just released then.
Yeah.
Because it's a little flag, it's a little moment in their life, a little marker, and they associate everything that they're doing in their life around that time. It could be life events, it could be getting married,
it's also a snap picture of your life as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that's the way I look at it. You know, when I look back at all the albums, I could pretty much tell you word by word what we're doing based on that album. Yeah, that's an interesting thing in itself, in, you know...
They're time capsules, aren't they?
Yeah. That's exactly what the word I was thinking of. But, you know, as far as fans, there's also that emotional attachment. Yeah. You know, there might be a period in their life where your music helped get through some hard times. I've often had people write to me saying, man, you really got me through my teenage years, you know, or something like that. And I'm like, oh, cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. You know, it's that emotional music can do what nothing else can do to people.
Yeah.
You know,
it's an escape, it supports, it does so many things for people.
It's a total escape, you know, and you can put on any style of music and it can just take you away from whatever you want to get away from.
Yeah.
And I think that's, nothing can be that powerful.
Absolutely.
Nothing else.
Well, before we wrap it up, I believe that you may have worked in a record store back in the day.
I owned one.
You owned one?
Mm.
Now, what was the name of that store?
The Metal Factory.
Metal Factory. Now, I'll see if I get this right, because I've got to thank you. I'm going to document it for him, because he'll be chuffed. I've got a mate of mine, Craig, that he said back in the day, he walked into your store, and he may have bought a Faith No More record, and you had told him that they were going to be touring in the coming weeks. And he didn't know about it. And because of that, and I guess this is just back in the day and, you know, not having the internet and the smartphone and everything like that and being, you know, instantaneously finding out about information, but it was because of you he found out about the show. He went to the show. He got to drink with Patton and he had one of the most incredible nights of his life. And he said, when I was telling him I was going to meet up with you, he said, please tell Matt. I said, thanks, because it was one of the best moments of my life. So there you go. So those sort of connections through music, and that's from a completely different angle altogether again, but you working in a store and having this record store, you could give these moments to people just through music and just supplying people with tunes that they love and
give them
heads up about shows.
in saying that, one of the best moments ever was when Dream Theater's first album came out.
Okay, yeah.
Because Mike Portnoy had written to me through Metal Forces.
No way.
Wanted Mortal Sin's album, so I sent him the album. He sent me a Majesty demo. And he said, "Oh, this is my. It's not like thrash what you do, yeah. but it's. Tell me what you think. You know, rada rada." And when their first album came out, I put it on the record store. I played it nonstop. Anyone who walked in, like, "God, guys, listen to this! Listen to this! You got to listen to this!" And I must have sold 150 records just because of the. Man, you got to check this out. This is wow. so fucking cool, you know. But that's what I like being in a store. That's cool. You know, you could enthuse upon everyone.
Well, you never knew who was going to walk in either. So it's like the guy in London playing your record and not knowing who walks into the store then. So you suddenly got a little bit of influence of hopefully connecting people together as well through music.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Funny old world, music. Oh. I love it. I don't know what I could... Well, I don't know where I'd be if I wasn't...
Oh, I don't know where a lot of us would be without music, but you, I mean, it's just, I mean, you've achieved a lot and seen a hell of a lot, and I think you've certainly left a stamp, at least from the outside perspective, looking in, you've left a big mark.
Well, you know what, I mean, you know, you get people saying, oh, you guys were so successful.
Yeah.
But what's success?
Well, that's it. I mean, that's...
You know, like, my wife would tell you success equals money.
Yeah.
But we didn't make any money. So then how could you call yourself successful? Mm, yeah. But then when we talk about ticking boxes, is that success? Is success playing at a venue that you wanted to play at?
Yeah.
We played at Hammersmith Odeon, our first overseas international gig, and we played at Hammersmith Odeon. You know, like...
It's subjective, isn't it? It's, yeah. It depends on the person.
When you say all those things, yes, I look at all those tick boxes and I can be satisfied.
Mm.
But then I look at those untick boxes and I think, fuck, why didn't we do this or why didn't we do that or how come we didn't get to do this? You know, it's very subjective, very... It depends where your mindset is, you know.
Depends on the time of day.
Look, like I said, the tick boxes are enough. You know, I can say I'm retired and I ticked a lot of boxes.
Yeah.
But there's that little thing underneath that says, yeah, but you didn't fucking go to Asia. You didn't play in Japan. You didn't do this. You didn't do that. Yeah. You can torture yourself by all of that stuff. I think you've just got to look back at the good parts, you know, and say, yeah, I can be happy with that.
I think you've done well.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't. But
well, thank you very much for your time, Matt. Really appreciate it. Thank you. We're shaking hands. Cheers. Cheers, everyone. If you want to reach out to Matt or learn a little bit more about Mortal Sin, if you haven't heard of Mortal Sin, shame on you. No. If you go over to andysocial.net, I'm going to put a bunch of really cool videos of Mortal Sin, some music, some Spotify stuff. There's so many. I'm on a Spotify kick at the moment, guys. If anybody that's connected to me online will see that I've been whoring out music. I've created an Australian metal playlist. So I might put that in the show notes as well, so you can click on that. Just Spotify is just owning my world at the moment. So I'll put a bunch of Spotify links in there, YouTube videos, links to Mortal Sin's pages, and just any way that I can possibly find that you can support Mortal Sin, I'll put on the show notes over at andysocial.net. So please go and check that out. If you have any particular questions off the back of this chat that might be valuable for me as far as who I get on in the future, I've got a few other musos, especially some legendary musos that I'm hoping to get on in the coming months. And if you have questions or insights or something that you think might be particularly interesting to cover with some of these guys, please let me know, because I'm really, really enjoying learning a lot more about the mechanics behind how people get started and the do's and don'ts. And everybody's journey is different and there's no right or wrong way of doing things. But in the context of particular situations, there's certainly clear mistakes that people make and there's clear correct decisions that are made by some people that lead to success. So I always love to hear from people, and there's been a few musos, especially some young guys that have been contacting me recently, asking me a number of different questions. So please keep them coming, because it helps me formulate some questions for other guests in the future as well. So it's greatly appreciated. Thank you. So before I wrap it up, selfstarter.com.au. If you're into small business or you want to create your own business or whatever it is, please go over to selfstarter.com.au or search for Selfstarter on Facebook or your preferred podcast app, and you can learn all about Selfstarter. If you scroll back or rewind back to the intro of this episode, I go on a long-winded explanation of what that podcast is all about. But go to those links and you shall be able to discover more about Selfstarter.
Also, if you want to support this podcast, as always, social media links, love hearts, likes, emotional reacts, tagging, sharing, retweets, you know, all that sort of stuff. So all that sort of stuff helps with the algorithms of social media. So please, if you see something pop up in your newsfeed or if you go and click on one of my pages, please go through and just like everything. It means a lot for me. Also, if you want to shout me a beer or the froth off a beer, go over to andysocial.net and click on the shout me a beer button that takes you to paypal.me where you can give me, I don't know, 10 cents, 50 cents, a dollar, $5, $50 million, whatever you wish. That stuff helps a lot with this podcast. It also helps with me expanding out to things such as Self-Starter and whatnot and covering a lot of those costs of monthly hosting and different fees and whatnot. It's amazing how pricey this stuff can become when you dig yourself deeper and deeper into it. Also, Amazon portal, if you shop on Amazon regularly, I would really, really ask and strongly recommend clicking on the andysocial.net page and clicking on the Andysocial on the Amazon portal link, I should say, and then shopping via that link. There is an affiliate code that's marked into that link, and I get a small percentage of whatever you guys buy on Amazon. It doesn't change your shopping experience whatsoever, but it's a little kickback for me. And as said before, it helps cover a lot of these costs. So these little things here and there go a long way to keeping this podcast and everything else that I do moving in a forward direction. So thank you so much for the people that do that. I get little alerts and I can see the statistics and the graphs and the tallies go up, and it means a lot to me to see that people are taking a little bit of extra time to support the podcast. But as I've said in the last few episodes, ultimately all I need from you guys is to listen and enjoy it. And if that's all that I'm getting from you guys, that's all I want. And I'm so happy that you guys continue to listen to this. I see people sharing it around, which is fantastic. But really, if you guys just tune in each week and you listen to these episodes, that's all I want. And that's what means the most to me. So thank you as always. Now, I don't even know what episode this is. Maybe it's 107, possibly. Now, I am going to be taking a break over the Christmas and January period. Now, I don't know what week this episode falls on, so I need to be conscious of that. There will be at least one more episode after this one, maybe two more. I don't know. Anyway, there will be an episode that is recorded prior to the break, which will give full context as to why I'm doing it and what's going on. But ultimately, with Self-Starter kicking into full steam now, and TY's going off on a bit of a trip for 6 odd weeks, I figured this might be a great opportunity to put the pause button on the Andysocial podcast and give everyone a break for that holiday period. And we will kick back into full swing on the 1st of February or whatever the first Thursday of February is. And I'll make sure it's a cracker of an episode to kick us back in. Now, a lot of podcasters that listen to this podcast might freak out and go, oh man, you're going to lose your momentum. But I'm going to ensure that I'm still producing a lot of other content in the meantime, which will hopefully continue to bring people to the podcast over that period of time. No doubt my numbers will drop a little bit, but this is a small sacrifice I have to make for the long term, and I need to ensure that the Andysocial podcast is something that will be still functioning and still running in the next 12 months, the next 5 years, the next 10 years. I really would love for this podcast to be part of my life indefinitely, and just to see people continue to listen to this podcast, watch me, well, not watch because you're not watching me, but to, I guess, observe and listen to me grow over the time and as I talk to lots of different people. And hopefully you guys will grow with me as we learn lots of different things and listen to me ask stupid questions. But I want this to be a part of my life. It already is. And as a result, I need to take care of it. And a little break over the holiday period, I think, will be absolutely amazing for this podcast, and it's going to give me some real fuel to kick into 2018, and I've got some big plans for 2018. So I'll give more context, I'll explain in further detail on an episode or the last episode before the break, so hang 10 on that, but that's where we're going. And until then, and until we get to that last episode or whatever, I don't even know when this is coming out. I should really plan this better. But thank you so much. Keep tuning in, and we will be back shortly. Okay, cheers, guys. Bye. You're ready. You're ready, social.